Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us from Monday to Friday from 11 to noon. Reach through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
You okay, Francis?
No. It's the world's gotten too stupid. It's gotten too stupid. We're gonna do another show today for you, everybody. We're gonna mix it up a little bit. We have a guy named Stephen Witherly, who's one of the most intelligent guys, writing about why you taste things the way you do, why you're drawn to junk food, why we like fat. I mean, he's the psychological reasons and the physiological reasons as to why it's great. Super intelligent guy. He sent us a couple of advanced copies of his book, which is coming out at the end of the year. We've had him on the show before. Amazing.
He was the most interesting guest we've ever had, I think.
And so that's going to be he's good guy. He's funny, and he's fun, and he loves food. He's great. So he's going to be on the second part of the show, and he's very smart. So we thought we'd start the first part of the show with something really stupid. Okay, I live in Jersey, and I got to tell you, we did a little piece on it. It was in the Star Ledger a while back.
Just last week,
a town in New Jersey, and again, if you're not in the local listening area and you're listening across the country on iTunes, there's a town in New Jersey called, it's spelled Bogota, and if you weren't living in a dumb state, you'd call that Bogota, because that's what it was named
for. Because it's named after a very large city.
But we're in New Jersey, so in here, our local parlance, that is known as Bogota. Yeah, hard to believe, isn't it? Anyway, in Bogota, they put up a sign in Spanish, advertising for McDonald's. Mm-hmm. And the mayor of Bogota, which is a town that mispronounces itself, is all up in arms about there being McDonald's advertising in Spanish. Wants to have it taken down. He's
so
offended.
We spent a good amount of time making fun of the mayor, saying, come on, who cares what...
Right.
How they advertise.
You're going to make the Italian, Little Italy change all the names.
Right.
The
you're going to make me get on McDonald's side.
Chinatown.
Shame on you for making me get on McDonald's side.
Chinatown's going to have to take down all the Chinese characters.
Anyway, we got another article that I slapped on Francis' desk that we didn't
Philadelphia.
Get to the other day.
Dateline Philadelphia. Bistec con queso? Not at Gino's Steaks. An English-only ordering policy has thrust one of Philadelphia's best-known cheesesteak joints into the national immigration debate. Situated in a South Philadelphia immigrant neighborhood, Gino's, which together with its chief rival, Pat's King of Steaks, forms the epicenter of an area described as ground zero for cheesesteaks. It's posted small signs telling its customers, "This is America," capital letters. When ordering, speak English.
Okay.
Don't know how lucky they are. All we're asking them to do is learn the English language, said Gino's. Gino's owner, Joseph Vento, son of Italian immigrants.
What happened to our sense of civility? Where has it gone? Where did we go? Where did we go from, okay, I'm in a service industry, I'm going to try and, service my customers and do everything I can to make them feel comfortable, to now we have the cheesesteak Nazi?
I think it's that if you've never left the country, and we live in a country where the president of the United States never left the country until he became president, and I'm not criticizing him, I'm saying that socially, if you've ever been in a foreign country, if you've ever traveled anywhere and had someone help you, or have a little sign to give you a little...
Or felt helpless, been on a train and not known if you were going to the right place, and needed to talk to somebody and ask them something.
And let's talk about America. Okay, yes, one of our great attributes. Yes, if you want to say official business of the United States has to be conducted in English, and we're going to try and teach everyone English, so that they may know all their different languages, but one of our great strengths is that from sea to shining sea, we have this huge common market that speaks English. I got it. That's a great thing to try and preserve.
Mm-hmm.
But the cheese... You can't order a cheesesteak in Spanish? That's what America's all about? You know? He says,
and don't try to get spicy peppers on it or else.
You know, it's like, But again, you know, when this guy goes into an Italian restaurant run by Italians, you would have to, he'd say, oh, I'm sorry, you can't call it farfalle quattro formaggi. You have to call it bow ties and cheese.
Awful. What other ridiculous things did he say?
Here's what the article points out. And this is an article, and I believe it's the Star Ledger. Yeah, I think it's the New Jersey Star Ledger. Yeah. And I love that this Patrick Walters, it's an Associated Press piece, actually, that appeared in the Star Ledger. Of course, it's not as if the native Philadelphians speak the King's English either. A Philadelphian might order a cheesesteak by saying something like, yo, give me a cheesesteak wit, use. yo, give me a cheesesteak wit, will use? And wit meaning with, use meaning you, gimme meaning give me, and yo meaning hello. So I think that we could shorten the English-only policy, but we should enforce it on Gino's staff as well.
Right.
And when you go and order a cheesesteak, I say, I'll have a cheesesteak. Yo, we'll be right with you. No, I'm sorry. Unless you pronounce it correctly, I'm not paying you. Unless you pronounce things correctly, Gino, we're not going to pay you.
And no finishing your sentences with prepositions.
Yeah, right. No ending sentences with prepositions here, Gino. We're going to have to speak the Queen's English. Look, you know, one of the things this guy's doing, in fairness to him, is when someone comes in, he's trying to teach them, and he's trying to help. And he says, listen, English only, and we'll try and help you. He says he's never turned away a customer, and he helps people by pointing at things, et cetera, and so forth. Yeah, I get it, Gino. You're the cheesesteak guy, not the English language teaching
guy.
Right,
you're not the UN, okay? Give the guys cheesesteak. Cheesesteak.
Cheesecake.
You can give him cheesecake, too, okay?
And eat it, too. I don't know. I think that one of the great things about our country is going to Little Italy, is going to Down Neck in Newark, which for those of you around here, if you want some of the best Portuguese food in the United States, you can go to Down Neck in Newark.
And if you're from Japan and you're here visiting and you want to visit one of those cultural areas that exist in a lot of these great cities, somebody should tell you that
this is America. I don't get it. Well, and also, like, look, one of the great values to our city in Boston is the Little Italy of Boston, which is very authentic. In so many cities, including New York, is Chinatown. You go to Chinatown, and there are Chinese signs, okay? Why? That's America, and it's great. And I go to Chinatown because of that.
Right, exactly, because I have this little bastion of ethnicity in this little area where I can get something that's true. You know, we're going to move off of this for a second, and I'm just going to give Francis a little piece of news that will make him really happy. Those of you who listen to the show a lot know that we can't stand Gordon Ramsay's television on Fox called Hell's Kitchen, where he goes and berates people and yells at them and screams at them. And
no me gusta. The Hell's Kitchen. Sorry. Hell's Kitchen del Diablo.
So he's constantly screaming at this housewife from Dubuque, telling her that her souffle didn't rise, and you know why can't she be a real chef? And the answer is because she's not a real chef. The great news is we're winning.
Yeah, Hell's Kitchen got
Kitchen's ratings dropped by 17% recently.
You know, this
hooray for us. Hooray for you, America. Turn him off. He's an idiot.
This guy, Gordon Ramsay, is a guy who just yells at people and berates people and humiliates people. And that is the old image of what a chef was. And actually, we work in the business. That's what an old chef was. And hopefully this guy's days are numbered and they're over. And I don't care how great his food is. Mm-hmm. If he's not a good human being, and that's not what food is all about.
And this
Gordon
guy's
Ramsay.
An internationally renowned chef that's getting his rocks off by berating people, by trying to you know, just belittle people and make them feel small. Shame on you.
You want to look at what a great chef is? A leader, not an abuser. And there's a difference. Look at Tom Colicchio. Look at Thomas Keller. Look at Charlie Trotter. You know, look at Rocco Di Spirito. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some of you may not like what happened with Rocco Di Spirito's public persona, but he's a great chef and a great leader and a great teacher. And that's what this business is all about. Listen,
Hell's Kitchen one step closer to being canceled.
but Top Chef coming back on the air.
That's
so
right.
We're going to see that very soon. Very excited. Back in a moment with Stephen Witherly, one of the top food experts in the nation, to explain to you why you like what you do, even if it's not good for you. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hey, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. And our guest today is Dr. Stephen Witherly. He's been on the show once before, but he has a new book that's going to be coming out at the end of the summer. Dr. Witherly's a PhD in human nutrition. He's written several dissertations on taste perception, which are fascinating, and you can link to some of them from the prior show on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. And he's just in the process of writing a book, Why Humans Like Junk Food, Food Pleasure Defined. Stephen, welcome back to the show.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be here.
Welcome back, Stephen. I have to tell you, and I'm not blowing smoke, you are actually my favorite guest in the whole history of the show so far.
Whoa. I'm impressed. Thank you so much.
Well, you got to teach me. You taught me how to feed my kids broccoli and have them eat it and all sorts of good things like that. Absolutely. My kids all eat broccoli now.
Wow, look at you. Changing it one little mouth at a time, changing the world. No, I have to say, we do a lot of research for our shows. And you know, it's funny out there. I don't want to break my arm patting myself on the back. But you're
not afraid to either.
But we often get people who say, because we do run two restaurants as well, and we get people on the show and they say, wow, you actually read the book, you know. And I guess most radio hosts like read the press release or something. But we did a lot of research. But when we had you on the show last time, I learned so much. So let's start teaching people. Hopefully, they can learn some of these things as well. You sent us some advanced copies of chapters of the book, and they're amazing.
Right.
What makes us like foods that are bad for us?
Well, it comes down to this. It comes down to our evolutionary past. And we were guided by evolution and what was in the environment. And as we evolved, we found out that there's certain things that the brain really likes. And that is, they like salt. The brain likes fat. It likes sugar. And recently, it's been discovered the brain really likes protein.
Mm-hmm. You know what? One of the things from our first show that I remember very distinctly, that not just our brain, but our belly likes some of those things as well, and it's our stomach after we've eaten those things that then tells us
good boy.
We should eat more of those types of things.
Well, you're absolutely correct, and the mechanism has been worked out. It's found that when you put calories in your stomach, it releases a compound called CCK, and that makes you feel happy and restored. And so it's the gut, the fat cell, and the brain that guides the way we make food.
And I'm not kidding here. When I eat my grandmother's lasagna, I feel great when I'm done. And Francis looked at me. Francis and I, when we were researching the Catherine Lombardi restaurant, I took him to a couple of my old Brooklyn haunts. We would come out of these places, and Francis would be like, "What's wrong with you? It's like you're drunk on something." I'm like, "It's the lasagna. I'm telling you, absolutely. Every time I just get." You know, I feel great after eating that kind of food.
Can you explain that?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I can't. Lasagna has two things in it. One, it has cheese, and the other thing, it has starch. Now, starch, when it breaks down quickly, increases insulin, and insulin is actually creates pleasure in the brain. And the other thing is, in the cheese that's in there, cheese contains caseomorphins. Caseomorphins are morphine-like molecules that in the body get absorbed and actually can create pleasure. That's why people like cheese, we believe.
So I'm fat because I'm addicted to morphine? Is that what you're telling me?
No, because you're addicted to sausage and cheese.
Well, it
didn't take a scientist to figure that one out, Mark.
but that's an example of our biological systems that most people don't even know how they work, but we tap into them through the foods that we eat, and we know they're good, but we don't know why, and that's the whole point of this book, is try to explain in simply, which is actually very, it's not so simple, why we like what we do.
Well, let's take this, you know, the way it seems as though things have been designed in nature so that we like the things that are good for us. But it seems as though very processed foods from food companies, like Pop-Tarts, for example, have figured out a way to create that pleasure without doing the things that are good for us. It's sort of taking advantage of what we like but not delivering on the good stuff. Is that a fair analysis?
Yeah, that's actually pretty true. The food scientists over the centuries and even chefs know that certain things you put in food makes it taste good. And then if you load them up on certain ingredients like sugar or high fructose corn syrup, which you actually talked about in a couple of shows past, they're kind of short-circuiting the natural things in life so that they're making things pleasurable that we probably shouldn't eat.
you know, it's funny. I have a rule. If you read the list of ingredients and there's anything on there that you either can't pronounce or don't know what it looks like in its raw state, I sort of avoid it because you know, the idea is food scientists who work for companies it's designed to make something taste good and make you want it again.
That's correct.
And regardless of what's inside it. And in the case of, you know, the McNugget, that's not exactly gonna serve you well. What kinds of things are we naturally averse to?
Well, I mean, at first, those we don't like them or stuff that we naturally really like.
Stuff that we naturally don't like.
We don't like when you combine certain foods that are really dissimilar, you put them together in one thing, people really hate that kind of thing.
Like what kinds of foods? Examples.
Oh, if, for example, if you mixed tuna with hamburger, you mix it together, the brain sees those as two separate foods, and they're not supposed to, they don't mix well.
And that's hardwired.
Yes, exactly. It's hardwired. It's a protection mechanism so that you don't eat stuff that's not familiar. Paul Rosen talked about that in one of your shows past. That was a great guest, by the way.
Yeah.
Actually, we're going to talk in the very next segment a little bit about Paul Rosen and one of his theories that you chronicle in your book.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Our guest is Stephen Witherly. He is one of the most interesting writers on exactly why you like what you do. And I think if you read his articles, and you can link through our website in a past show we did, and we'll put this one up as well, to some interesting stuff that will give you greater insight as to how your mind and your body works about food. And it will really enhance your appreciation of how to cook good food, and also, like Mark said, how to help your kids eat better. Back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1125.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Kathleen Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Kathleen showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission? To live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. You see, Kathleen Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or KatherineLombardi.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. Our guest today is Dr. Stephen Witherly, one of our favorite writers on food, the science of food, and why you like what you like.
Dr. Witherly, we were talking just a minute ago about a guy by the name of Paul Rosen and some of his ideas and theories about why we like what we like. And one of the things was that I want to talk about is the mere exposure effect.
Right.
Well, why don't you talk to people about just exposure and how that works?
Yeah, mere exposure effect is something that's been out there a long time, and it's real quite simple. Every food could be a potential poison, but if you get exposed to it just by touching, smelling, looking at it, the more often that happens, the more often you'll like it. For example, if your kids like something or hate something, just exposing them to it in 5 to 7 trials, they'll start to like it. So you shouldn't get mad at your kids, shouldn't yell at them. Just put the food on their plate, let them play with it, and eventually they'll eat it and you got it.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I guess the idea was back in the ancient, you know, when you came back to the campfire after the hunt, that, you know, if anybody brought back something that was poisonous, well, they ate it and then they died. But if they ate it 4 or 5 times, you're like, yeah, I guess I can eat that too.
Foods that you were familiar with, you were more likely to survive.
But this can be changed. And one of the, I think, the most fascinating things that we can talk about is acquired taste. Because I think one of the sure signs of the decline of Western civilization is that we're not taking the time to acquire tastes, like bitter things like Amaro. And you know, there are a lot, and coffee was an acquired taste for most people. Why do we acquire taste? Why do we go by doing it, and how has our brain changed from having our first sip of coffee at 10 years old and saying, that's disgusting, to, you know, now I have 6 cups a day?
Well, I can answer that. You learn to like something by what it does to the body. Say you got coffee and you drink black coffee, you learn to like it because suddenly you feel energized or you feel the effects of caffeine, but you have to absorb it. For example, Brie smells like somebody's underwear, right? It's awful, but it's 70% butterfat. So when that butterfat hits your intestines, it sends a signal to your brain going, what you just ate means survival. Eat it again. And that's the key, is to put it in your mouth, chew it, and swallow it, and let your stomach taste it again.
And that was one of your suggestions for kids, too, put butter or something on something that they won't eat, and then...
Then because we're restaurant professionals and don't know much about the actual FCC guidelines, I can't make any underwear jokes right now because I don't know where the line is. So we're going to have to take a quick break for the news, but afterwards we're going to come back and talk more with Dr. Stephen Witherly, and we're going to talk about Doritos breath and Doritos feet and food that's unlikely but that we like anyway.
And we'll talk to the people at the station about the jokes we can and can't make.
Back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Today, our guest is Dr. Stephen Witherly. He has a PhD in human nutrition. He's written several dissertations on taste and perception, all of which are just fascinating, and you can find links to them on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. He's writing a book, which will be out at the end of the summer, called Why Humans Like Junk Food, Food Pleasure Defined. Dr. Witherly, we talked about some of the things we're hardwired for, and it sort of makes sense. You write that, you know, we look for salt because our body needs salt, so we have a natural, we like it. We look for sugar because that means calories, and we like it. We, as humans, look for protein because we need protein. And there are certain things that we're naturally averse to. We're averse to bitter things because most poisons in nature are bitter.
That's correct.
But acquired tastes and how tastes change over time, I think, are really fascinating. You have a whole section in one of the advanced chapters of your book that you sent us on Doritos. And, you know, you're a very organized guy, much more organized than we, in, except in how we run the dining room. But I love how you've sort of broken this stuff out. It's fascinating. And you deal for quite a bit with Doritos. And you have subsections for Doritos breath, Doritos feet, and in the Doritos feet, you talk about bacteria and fungi, yeast, are normal inhabitants of moist feet and can generate aromas similar to the smell of Doritos. Yet we find the feet objectionable and the Doritos addicting. Why is that?
Well, it's probably we don't eat feet, and that's probably part of it, and it's part of your own body. But I looked at Doritos. Doritos is the number one snack around the world, a snack. Everybody loves that stuff. And I looked at the flavor complex. And the reason I talk about Doritos breath is that I found out a number of years ago that many people that worked for the company thought Doritos tasted too close like other bad smelly things. So they tinkered with the formula so it didn't smell like feet and bad breath.
They did?
Yes. It was too high in garlic.
Well, that's okay. So why when I'm eating garlic, do I love it? Garlic, do I love it? God, that's horrible, unless he begins eating garlic as well.
Well, it's kind of funny. Garlic is a secret weapon pleasure food. I've discovered in my research that garlic is a few things that people don't even know about. When you taste garlic in the mouth, it activates a receptor called the umami receptor. That's the protein receptor. So it activates the taste for protein, and it amplifies the taste of salt. Few people actually knew this, but the French did figure this out a long time ago.
Mm-hmm. Well, why, though, does garlic... I mean, garlic... you know, they always say, you know, if you're going to have garlic on a date, both of you should have garlic
on a date.
Absolutely,
sure.
Why is it, when I'm eating it, very pleasant, and if I've eaten it, the smell of it on someone else is fine, but so unpleasant, you know, Doritos breath is unpleasant. The smell of someone's actual stinky feet we find offensive. However, if someone opens a bag of Doritos and we eat them, that's pleasant.
And the reason is when you smell something and you look at where the source comes from, if you smell it in a bag, that single food, it's your own. If you smell it on something else, you look at it, and that's not food, that's a person. It's called cognitive dissonance. You got the smell, and you got the source, and you're not food. I can't eat my feet. So your brain, like, freaks out and says, oh, that's disgusting. And that gets very close to Paul Rosen's theory on disgusting foods. It's flavors and tastes that are not supposed to be there can freak you out.
See, I thought it was just the exposure effect where I'm used to Francis smelling bad, so therefore I just got used to it.
And I think you've learned to tolerate it over these many years. The guy's been together a long time.
I know. It's horrible. Anyway, you mentioned, and this is another chapter in your book, you mentioned secret weapons, secret weapon pleasure foods.
Yeah, you just mentioned that garlic is one of those secret weapon pleasure
Absolutely.
Foods.
Absolutely.
And you list a bunch of them, and this is actually very helpful, I think, to people who like to cook and people who like to eat. Talk to us about why these are so powerful and what some of them are.
I can certainly do that. I mean, you guys are restaurant professionals. You do consulting, and you recognize the value of this. These are foods you can put in your cooking today without even changing anything, the flavor profile, but it will be better, and they're small things. For example, soy sauce is a secret weapon, pleasure food. So is cheese. So is garlic. And my favorite of all is Parmesan cheese addition to foods. That's a secret weapon.
Why are those particular foods so universally appealing and so powerful?
And there's two reasons on this. The first reason is many of them are high in salt, and the brain loves salt. As a matter of fact, it's something that's been around. I mean, our bloodstream is 1% salt, so we're always looking around to try to find 1%. And the second thing, and almost nobody knows this, these foods contain natural MSG, and sometimes they're in really high quantities.
Look, you just touched on something that I want to go back to. Okay. The blood is 1% salt.
All right.
So we are trying to seek things in nature that are 1% salt.
Is that
now,
true?
That's a very good insight. My research shows that it looks like it's about 1.5% is the absolute perfect level of salt. But you're right. We're trying to basically find stuff in the environment that's like our bloodstream.
Wow. You know
and,
what's funny?
And what things are like that besides Parmesan cheese?
Well, you know, all the secret sauces that, you know, bacon's about 3-4% salt. That's one of the reasons we like bacon. But cheeses all are 2-3% salt.
You know what's funny? When we make fresh mozzarella to order in Catherine Lombardi restaurant.
Oh, fabulous.
And it's amazing. And sometimes what I often say, look, I'm Irish boy, right? But I went to Mark's house a lot. I grew up in a town that was a third Irish, a third Italian, and a third African American. And what the Irish kids was always try to get invited over to the Italian kids' house for dinner.
I grew up in a town that was like 97% Italian.
And two Irish guys that got beat up a lot. But what we say to these young externists, I'm like, because I've heard, you know, Mark's family yell at people and other people's family yell at people. When they're making the fresh mozzarella, you make fresh mozzarella in a bath of hot water.
Right.
And it's always undersalted when in other places. And with our young externs and our young people working on it, I taste it, and it's like the ocean. It should taste like the ocean. Should I be telling them that it should taste like their blood?
Well, you know, it's kind of funny you mention that because I talk about that in another chapter. But we came out of the ocean a long time ago. Mm-hmm. Some of us maybe sooner than others. But the ocean is about...
I got that.
Okay, thanks. But the ocean is about 4% salt. But I took the average of all the junk and snack foods out there. It comes out at 1.5. So you're right on. Salt is... I mean, they say salt's bad for you, but you know what? It's in our blood.
Mm-hmm. Well, what happens with really great mozzarella is if you're making mozzarella, you should, and that's the old adage, that the water in which you make the mozzarella should be the same salinity as the ocean.
Well,
now, of course, the ocean differences from place to place, but then the cheese itself, probably, I'm guessing, if the water is 3% salt.
Well, we're talking about the Jersey Shore, so.
Then the and a hypodermic needle thrown in there. But if the water winds up being 3% salt, I'll bet you that mozzarella comes out at about a percent and a half salt, something like that.
You probably hit it right on at the preferred level. And that is a little secret I hope almost nobody knows, but you got it by induction, and a concentrated solution gets into the mozzarella. So now you got casomorphins, you've got fat, you got mouthfeel, and mozzarella is great stuff.
Let's talk about mouthfeel, because we talked about the last time we were together how people like, and the magic, if you've never had fresh mozzarella, and supermarket mozzarella doesn't count, and even if you went to the mozzarella factory, the mozzarella store, if you got refrigerated mozzarella, if it's ever been refrigerated, it's not really great mozzarella.
Right.
But fresh mozzarella, It like melts in your mouth. That's a very appealing thing too.
The whole changing texture in your mouth. Talk to us about that for a second.
Yes, we can. As a matter of fact, that's the theory that I got published. Actually, Paul Rosen helped me. I published it in his journal.
Uh-huh.
That's called dynamic contrast, and that is the secret to like top chefs like Keller. I have a whole chapter in a book just on Thomas Keller and why he's great. But dynamic contrast states real simply, people like foods that when they're in the mouth, melt down quickly with texture contrast. All the greatest foods have quick meltdown, from popcorn to cheese to Doritos.
Ice cream, chocolate.
And the last time we spoke, it's funny, if you store ice cream, you ever go out someplace and you get ice cream in your freezer and you get the Ben & Jerry's ice cream, it's hard as a rock. But if you go to the scoop shop, the ice cream scoop boxes are kept at a higher temperature so that ice cream is just on the verge of melting and soft, because that's how they want you to eat it.
That's correct. That gives you the greatest pleasure. As a matter of fact, we wrote a paper on the ice cream effect, and of all the foods in the world tested by neuroimaging, ice cream is the most pleasurable single food ever created.
I totally agree.
I am so with you.
Hey, you know what? We're going to take a break for a commercial, but I want to give you guys a piece of practical advice out there. If you're serving a pint of Ben & Jerry's or Haagen-Dazs after your dinner and the oven's still warm from what you've cooked, take that pint of Ben & Jerry's out of the freezer, stick it in that still warm oven for just a couple of minutes, and you'll temper that ice cream and bring it down so it's not so rock hard. And if you get that ice cream just where it's cold enough that it hasn't yet started to melt, you're going to find yourself a much better treat. So that's a little trick for you at home.
I can't wait that long.
All right, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45. Economy Paver and Restaurant Supply Company is the oldest dealership in New Jersey. They've been equipping and supplying restaurants since 1932, and they know that to make great food, you need great equipment. You need equipment that doesn't break down, and you can't pay too much for it. Whether you need an emergency replacement or a wholesale kitchen renovation, Economy's knowledge, experience, and integrity are indispensable. Economy Paper and Restaurant Supply is a recognized dealer for all major brands, and they specialize in custom fabrication and ventilation. At Economy, they've got all the tools you need to get the job done, all in one place, all priced right, and delivered to your door. Economy is the only dealer in New Jersey that's been approved for on-site demonstrations of the Rational Combi Oven. The Rational Combi Oven is an innovative combination of convection and adjustable steam oven. It's a powerful and versatile tool in your kitchen's arsenal. They also supply competitively priced paper products and all the non-food supplies every restaurant needs. You can visit the Economy Demo Kitchen on Broad Street in Clifton, New Jersey. You can also visit economysupply.com, then call them at 973-279-5500. That's 973-279-5500.
Central Jersey Talk Radio. Central Jersey 1450. WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants. We're joined today by Stephen Witherly, who's been on the show before and joined us again, never ceases to stop fascinating us. His book coming out at the end of the summer is going to be called Why Humans Like Junk Food, Food Pleasures Defined. It talks about exactly why you like the foods that you do. And I think when you understand that, you can make better food at home and you can make better food choices. You can find out more about Dr. Witherly's work on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Dr. Witherly, you talked about garlic, and I want to talk about something that I'm going to coin the Midwest effect. Now, we're running an Italian-American restaurant based on the recipes of Mark's grandmother from Brooklyn.
Right.
There's a woman in the restaurant, month and a half after we opened, she said, you know, the food's okay, but there's too much garlic in everything. And I thought, oh, ma'am, you're in the wrong restaurant because we're not changing that. And, you know, I think in many restaurants today that the level of garlic has gone down from in ethnic pockets where the garlic was very high. And if you're in Ohio, you know, the level of garlic that people like is very different than in a real Brooklyn Italian, Jersey Italian restaurant. There's huge amounts of garlic. What accounts for that difference in taste and why some people don't like it so intensely and why some people just adore it?
Well, it's probably exposure. People who don't like garlic probably didn't eat a large amount of it, didn't get exposed to it. If you notice, one of the secrets to Emeril's cooking on TV is he loads garlic up, you know, his classic 48 cloves of garlic. Once you're exposed at a high level, your brain and body know, hey, this is actually much better, because garlic excites the protein taste, and it also excites what's called pleasure receptors for cold and heat. That's another secret of garlic. So that is, you can put garlic in at levels that they don't detect, but at high levels, it activates taste reception like no other food I've ever seen.
But it has to be at high levels.
Not necessarily.
Okay.
Here's another little trick. The more raw the garlic is, the more potent the taste.
Mm-hmm.
If you remember, the French take garlic, they cut it in half, raw garlic, and just rub the inside. And if you cook garlic, it takes away a lot of that mellowness, but it still has some taste type of components. So it depends on how much you cook the garlic for the effect.
Now, one of the things that is described in your book is that a lot of these things we learn in childhood and in infancy, but at the same time, we can acquire taste for foods like this, for garlic and tolerances for garlic and things like this, as we become adults.
Right. Yeah, and the key on that is exposure. The mere exposure effect says that just seeing a food, you'll get more familiar with it. But the key is putting it in your mouth, tasting it, and if you don't die, and it's not calories, you'll love it. And that's the absolute key.
Don't eat the holly berries.
Stephen.
Well, can you get tired of foods? Do we tire of flavors?
As a matter of fact, that's an excellent question. That's called sensory-specific satiety. within 10 minutes of eating the food, the brain stops your pleasure response. That's within 10 minutes, and that was a study done by Edmund Rolls. And what your brain starts looking for is a different flavor, texture, or contrast. It only takes 10 minutes of exposure.
So if I'm eating garlic, after 10 minutes, it stops being pleasurable and then could become annoying.
Yes,
if it's only garlic.
Yeah, but it's possible. But garlic is special because it's a taste and not so much. It's hard to get, you know, like, if you eat something sweet all the time, you still will do that because sweet is so hardwired pleasure. But I'm talking about a color or a flavor. You just start burning out on that.
So you if you're eating broccoli rabe and just broccoli rabe, 10 minutes in.
Absolutely. You want to get near it.
Interesting. All right. Now, the one flavor that you talk about that is the most universally appealing flavor that we never tire of is vanilla.
That's correct.
What is it about vanilla?
Well, it's kind of funny. I give many lectures and people challenge me with questions, and vanilla flavor, apparently, I was giving a lecture and a scientist walked up and goes, "Hey, I know why vanilla flavor is universal like." I go, "Why?" He goes, "It's the major flavor of breast milk." I go, "You're kidding me." He goes, "No." So everybody, most of us, have had breast milk as kids, and that flavor is in the brain, and for some reason, scientists are not sure why, vanilla never burns out.
I was a formula baby, and I'm trying to make up for it for the rest of my life. I mean, in eating vanilla.
So what you're telling me is creme brulee is as close to breast milk as I'm going to get at this point in my life?
It's probably higher in calories, but you're close.
Oh, Lord. All right, now, on the other side of things, I guess I had gotten used to something that I now do think of as poison, but not really. I take that back. I'm going to get sued. But I remember when I was a kid, I used to like SpaghettiOs. I remember in college, someone would open a can of processed, you know, Chef Boyardee spaghetti or whatever.
Oh, that's good stuff.
And now, I was over someone's house, and they opened up a can of like, processed tomato-based
I remember being much more tolerant of those foods.
And I thought it was like someone was cooking dog food. It was revolting.
Mm-hmm. And we can explain that.
I opened a can of soup recently, and it smelled exactly like
stew.
Dog food.
It was stew at your house. And I was like, this is dog food. Why am I so revolted by that now when I ate it 25 years ago?
Well, what happens is we get older, we get more sophisticated, and our food memories get better. When you take a food and put it into a can, in fact, I talked about this in a chapter, and you retort it, it creates off flavors. And as your palate has become more sophisticated, that off flavor now is become conditioned to dog food. So if you have dogs or pets, that's the major smell of pet food.
Mm.
And we don't eat pet food anymore.
I try not to.
Well,
times get tough once in a while, Stephen, but not, you know, not that bad.
Sometimes the little biscuits aren't bad.
I used to work for a company that made pet food. You don't want to eat that stuff.
You know,
we
have to leave it there, but Stephen, I feel like we could talk to you for hours.
I mean, you sent us two chapters of your book that we have only scraped
the
top of.
But we've only got a couple of seconds, so we need to say goodbye. But will you come back and talk with us again?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. So look for a show in the near future, if not tomorrow, when we get off the air. We'll talk to Shari about when we can schedule this. To have Stephen Withley talking about his new book, Why Humans Like Junk Food, Food Pleasure Defined. Send us an email, francis@restaurantguysradio.com, and I'll send you an email when the book comes out, and we're going to make a fuss about it. It's absolutely one of the most fascinating books we've read.
I appreciate it.
You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, stage left at Catherine Lombardi Restaurant. Wow, that guy is smart.
Every time I
he
talk
so
to him.
He is so smart.
Every time I read one of his articles, I'm like, you know what it is? He puts it in such plain terms. So many of the doctors and scientists that we talk to or read, you know, their theories aren't related to what's actually in front of you each day. You know, he's got theories on Oreo cookies and why we like Oreo cookies. He's got theories on Doritos and why we like Doritos.
And these aren't just like pie in the sky theories. These are well worked out, well researched theories, pie in the sky. Well, you know, and one of the interesting things is a lot of the food scientists, I remember I was sitting in a plane once on a way back from Ireland and I sat next to a guy who's like, "Oh, what do you do?" You know, you're sitting there, you're 6 hours in transcontinental flight, and the guy's like, "What do you do?" I said, "Oh, I'm in the restaurant business." "Oh, I'm in the food business too." "Oh, that's interesting, you know." I thought that was interesting. I said, "I own a couple of restaurants." He said, "Yeah, I'm a food scientist." "Oh, you're a food scientist. What do you do?" He's like, "Well, you know, my claim to fame was that, for Cool Whip, remember when they came out with a package that had 40% more Cool Whip for the same price?" "Yeah." "Well, what I did was I figured out a way to get 40% more air suspended in Cool Whip and that sort of substitution."
And then you raised your hand and said, "Stewardess, can you move my seat?"
And he had said something when we first met, like, "Oh, yeah, we do kind of the same thing for a living. I'm a food scientist." And I thought, we don't do the same thing at all for a living.
But no joke. I mean, in their first show we had with Dr. Witherly, he talked about, you know, putting butter on broccoli and exposing your kids to broccoli. And by experimentation with my 3-year-old at the time, who's now 4 years old, we put on her plate vegetables every single time. No matter what happened, even knowing she wasn't going to eat them for a while, put vegetables on her plate. Well, don't you know that she eats them now? You know, right. she doesn't love them. They're not the first thing she goes for, but she just picks them up and eats
them.
And
much better than the screaming match my mom had with me.
Way better.
And the contrast, I wish I'd had a dog, you know. Mm. But the contrast between, you know, that food scientist, the Cool Whip food scientist, who maybe is listening to the show, I don't know, hey out there, and Dr. Witherly, it couldn't be further, because Dr. Witherly, you know what? He loves food, and he wants people to have good food and have pleasure from food. And he set about to explain. I think that's absolutely fascinating. We have to go. He's going to come back on the show next week sometime. Hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I am Francis Schock.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.